Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me here, MLB.com national editor Matt Myers. And Matt, you may have noticed that there were some trades made in the last couple of days, so we're going to obviously talk about all those. We have to also talk about Giancarlo Stanton and some really interesting hitters on the Texas Rangers. Plus, we're going to induct a new player into our StatCast Hall of Fame. But first, let's talk about the big trade of the week. Mike Leake going to Seattle. Wait, no, sorry. Justin Verlander finally got moved. I got to be honest. I think I went to bed at like 5 of midnight last night and thought, nah, this wasn't going to happen. And then I wake up this morning and all of a sudden Justin Verlander is on the Astros. So are you surprised that this actually happened?
Yes, because I didn't think they'd be able to come to an agreement on prospects, because it seemed like that my thought was the Tigers would probably be holding out for Kyle Tucker, the Astros' top prospect, and that the Astros wouldn't be willing to budge on that. So instead they went for a little more quantity over maybe quality, and they got the Astros, I guess, number 3 prospect, starting pitcher Franklin Perez, their number 9 prospect outfielder, Daz Cameron, Mike Cameron's son, if you want to feel old, and catcher Jake Rogers, their number 11 prospect. So I think this is a fascinating deal for both sides, and I'm sort of glad the Astros did it, because I think that based on the roster they have now, they needed another high-level starting pitcher, I think, to feel good about competing in postseason series against other elite teams.
It seems to me a pretty fair trade for both sides, which a certain someone told me was just the opposite of a hot take on Twitter this morning. I mean, I think it was. You know, the Tigers did pretty well for themselves here, and so did the Astros, because they get Verlander, and they gave up good prospects, but not, you know, their number 1 prospect or number 2 prospect. So, you know, I think the Tigers made some really hard choices, and we'll talk about Justin Upton in a second as well. But it's interesting to me is, who is Justin Verlander right now? Like, what version of Justin Verlander are the Astros going to get? Because last year he was really good. He probably should have won the Cy Young last year. You know, he lost to 22 wins worth of Rick Porcello. And I think the question here is, are you going to get the Verlander who kind of started off the year with like a 5 ERA for the first 3 months, or the Verlander who's been really, really good? So if we look at his stats here, first 17 games started, 4.96 ERA, not so great. 4.34 ERA, FIP, not so great. His last 9 starts, though, 2.31 ERA, 3.64 FIP. Strikeout percentage up from 21 to 29%. His walks have dropped from 11% to 7%. That's a guy who looks more like the ace like Verlander that we've seen in years past. But it's interesting, it didn't come with like a huge velocity increase, didn't come with a new pitch. There's really no obvious underlying reason to explain why. I mean, as we were saying, it's probably something to do with location. That's really hard to kind of get into the numbers for.
Yeah, if anything, it might actually have had something to do with a slight velocity decrease, which I'll explain, which is that basically since the All-Star break, his slider velocity has been a little bit down, but creating a little more separation from the fastball velocity may actually be helping the pitch offer a little more deception. Before the All-Star break, he was throwing his slider at 89.5 miles an hour. Since then, it's been 87.2 miles an hour. So that's not insane. That's 2.5 miles an hour. And his whiff rate has doubled on that pitch. So it was 5% before the All-Star break. It's 10% since, or to be exact, 5.3% before, 10.7% since. When we talk about whiff rate, we're talking about on pitches where the batter swung.
Right.
So there's definitely something going on with the slider where dropping a little velocity has helped it play up from a performance standpoint, because he's getting a lot more swings and misses on the pitch.
And he's a guy who's always been kind of fascinating from a StatCast perspective, because he's got a very interesting fastball. You know, he's one of the guys we always talk about as having a high spin fastball, and even with all the miles in his arm, he still does. So we looked at 210 starters have thrown at least 104 seamers this year. His spin rate of 2,536 RPM is second of those 210. It's ahead of Darvish, it's ahead of Scherzer, it's behind, surprisingly, Tyson Ross, which I was a little surprised to see by that. But I guess, you know, that kind of goes back to when Tyson Ross has been healthy, that's part of the reason he succeeds. And his 95.3 miles an hour on his velocity is tied for 16th of 210 starting pitchers. So the velocity is still there, but as you said, it didn't really change from the first half, which kind of makes the whole thing a little bit confounding.
Yeah, on that four-seam spin rate, 2,500, as we've sort of talked about on the show before, 2,500 RPM spin rate on a four-seam fastball is kind of like the gold standard. You're talking about 80-grade spin rate, essentially. That's where you get that really, it allows for that extra deception, the rising fastball effect. And certainly that Verlander and Scherzer are guys that have really benefited from that in their careers, in addition to the elite velocity that comes with it. So you combine the velocity and the spin rate, that's a lot of deception on the fastball.
Yeah, and the difference between the good Verlander we've seen lately and the less good Verlander we saw early on, it wasn't really luck. I mean, if we look into our batted ball skill metric, our quality of contact with strikeouts, expected weighted on base, his first 17 games started, expected weighted on base was 346. He allowed a 335, so he basically earned all that. Second 9 games, 279 expected, and he actually has been getting a 261. So he's clearly just been better overall. But here's the one thing that stands out to me, and I kind of went back and forth on this. My initial thought was he's leaving Detroit for Houston. That's a huge ballpark difference, right? We talked so many times about Detroit's ballpark swallowing up deep batted balls to center field, and Houston still has this reputation as being an extreme hitter's park, but it hasn't actually played like that this year. And you look at Altuve, he's been a monster on the road. You look at Keuchel and McCullers, they've actually been much better at home. So I think the narrative is going to be, oh, well, he's going to give up some easy home runs down the lines. I'm not sure that's actually true anymore.
Yeah, it just has the fluky, the short down the lines. You get cheap homers down the lines in Houston because it happens on both sides. This isn't just Yankee Stadium where it's only shallow to one end, or Fenway Park where it's only shallow to the other end. It's shallow both lines in Houston. But other than that, it's actually not that forgiving of a park, particularly in the outfield of center field. So it's not necessarily going to be that much of a – I don't expect – the ballpark to have a major effect on his raw stats.
Right, and I agree with you. And I think that's what's interesting, because the initial expectation is, oh, that's a huge difference, but maybe in reality it's not. And for the Astros, this is a big deal. Obviously, they've been struggling for a couple weeks now. They are 11-17 in August. They still don't have to worry at all about the AL West, but this is about the playoffs. And if you look at their potential playoff rotation, and I hesitate to use the word rotation, because I don't really think we're going to see a traditional starting rotation for this team in the playoffs. Obviously, Verlander is starting one of your first two games. Keuchel, who's been somewhat up and down when he's been healthy, he was obviously really good to start the year and has been inconsistent since, probably starts one of your first two games. And then after that, I don't think you're really going to see a quote-unquote starter. I think you're going to see these kind of tandems, because in terms of talent, McCullers is probably your third best pitcher, but he's not healthy, and I think he's on a rehab assignment right now and hasn't really been that dominating. So you hope to get a couple innings out of him, and maybe you pair him with Brad Peacock or Charlie Morton or Colin McHugh. You get, three or four innings out of each of those guys, and that's half of a game, right there. And then you've got Chris Devensky, who's maybe one of the next Andrew Miller types that everybody talks about, and Joe Musgrove, who was not a very successful starting pitcher, 6.12 ERA, but has been pretty dominant in 20 innings as a reliever, 1.33. He's kind of like the new Devensky as well. You can get three or four innings, two or three innings, one or two innings, whatever, out of all of these guys after Keuchel and Verlander, and all of a sudden you've got yourself a playoff, not rotation so much as a staff.
Yeah, knowing what we know about the Astros and their sort of being an analytically driven, forward-thinking front office, and the fact that their manager, A.J. Hinch, is very, very well aligned with the front office's thinking for the most part, I cannot imagine we're going to see any of their starters, besides possibly Keuchel or Verlander, face a batter a third time in the postseason. And if they do, it'll only be because they're like cruising and they have a very short leash.
Right. And then, the bullpen has been up and down, but Ken Giles is very talented. Gregerson, Harris, if he comes back healthy. They have a lot of arms. They just need them to all be kind of healthy and performing at the same time. And this could very well be the Astros we thought we were going to see in the beginning of the season.
Yeah, and there's a couple more things about the Verlander trade from a big picture perspective I want to get to. First of all, is just sort of the long-term money aspect. He's owed $28 million over the next 2 years. Tigers are sending some money. So even that, the Tigers are saying, I think, $8
million per year. So he's owed $28 million next year and $28 million. The following year, the Tigers are sending $8 million per year. So the Astros really, I believe, owe $20 million next year and also $20 million the following year. They have waived his 2020 team option that was a vesting option. So basically, he's going to be a free agent after 2019, and he gets a full no trade from the Astros.
And it's also, from the Astros, they're in a team that has the flexibility to make this move. I looked at their long-term payroll commitments, and I think it's, for 2019, they have $50 million essentially committed, and that includes Verlander. And it's basically Verlander and Josh Reddick who comprise like $40 million of that. Because even Altuve, he has team options for 18 and 19 that are $6 and $6.5 million.
It's almost criminal. And I think Gurriel is signed for a couple years, but not a big money.
But Correa is going to obviously start getting raises once he hits arbitration. Springer, as he goes through arbitration, will get raises as well. But this is a team that has the flexibility to make this kind of move, particularly when you factor in that the Tigers are sending them some money. So it's a no-brainer from Houston's perspective.
It's a good trade for the Astros, it's a good trade for the Tigers, and it's a good trade for baseball. I mean, that's really exciting. And now you're a lot more excited about the Astros than you were, and it puts them in a very interesting class of teams as far as their rotation goes.
Yeah, and the one other quirky thing I wanted to mention about the trade and sort of getting into I don't know what is this butterfly theory? I don't know what the idea. If you look at one of the key components of this trade was Daz Cameron, who they drafted in 2015. And they basically, he was a guy who was supposed to be a top 10 pick, but fell because of signability concerns. However, in 2015, the Astros had a huge draft pool bonus because they had not signed Brady Aiken the year before. So they had two of the top five picks. So basically, they were the only team that was basically able to, once Daz Cameron fell, it basically was like, okay, the Astros are going to get him because they were the only team that really was going to be able to meet his bonus demands as like the number 35 pick or whatever it was. So basically, you could sort of like trace this trade back to them failing to sign Brady Aiken.
Which they got crushed for. And I remember in a previous life, I wrote like 4,000 words on the time about how they got unfairly crushed for that.
And they were, I mean, that was when they, and that was when they drafted Bregman and Kyle Tucker with two of the top five picks, and then got Daz Cameron, who they used as a piece to make this trade.
And that's exactly right. This is how you make these trades with deals like that. And it does make for an interesting potential postseason starting pitching collection. So right now there are 10 teams in position to make the playoffs. And I think obviously you look at the AL wild card, these are going to change a lot as time goes on. But I think you found something really interesting, right, about each of these 10 teams and their rotations right now. Nine of the 10 teams.
Hat tip to research wonk David Adler, that nine of the 10 teams, the playoffs started today, nine of the 10 teams would have a former Cy Young winner in their rotation.
Before you read these off, can I say, you said this to me this morning, and you said nine of the 10 teams, and I kind of thought through it in my head, and eight of the teams was pretty easy to come up with, right? Like, okay, the Dodgers have Kershaw. And I couldn't get that ninth team, and I kind of racked my brain. And then once you told me who it was, I kind of about fell off my chair. So tell us.
Okay, well, the Red Sox have Rick Porcello and David Price. Indians have Corey Kluber. I don't remember the years for all these guys, so I'm not going to even try. I know Porcello was last year, and that one is history is probably not going to be kind to that. That's Cy Young.
No.
Indians have Corey Kluber. Astros have Verlander and Keuchel. Yankees have CeCe Sabathia. The Twins have,
this
wait
is
for
the one,
it.
This is the one I couldn't get.
Give it to us.
Bartolo Colon from 2005. So now we're 12 years past and like probably 12 different teams for Colon past. And speaking of history not being kind to awards, Bartolo over Johan Santana that year is maybe one of the top three like heists I think we've ever
and
had.
Probably one of the worst signing decisions on record. Nationals have Max Scherzer. Cubs have Jake Arrieta. Dodgers have Clayton Kershaw. D-backs have Zane Greinke. And the Rockies are the one team that if the playoffs start today would not have a Cy Young winner in their rotation.
And I think that's less about altitude than it is about youth. I mean, everybody in that rotation, they don't really have a long-term veteran guy who's been around for years and years and years.
Yeah, and like as we saw with the Twins, having a Cy Young winner on your roster doesn't necessarily mean current quality, although Colon has been surprisingly good since coming to the Twins.
So the Verlander deal was not the only deal we had. There were a couple others we want to talk about. But very quickly first, if you love baseball, and if you're listening to our show, of course you do take the thrill of controlling your roster and smacking one out of the park with you everywhere you go with the number one baseball game on mobile, Tap Sports Baseball 2017. Go to the iTunes or Google Play App Store right now to download it today for free and start building your ultimate roster. Now, the Tigers also made another deal yesterday. They moved Justin Upton to the Angels. And when I first heard about that, I was like, oh, yeah, that makes a ton of sense because Justin Upton was probably going to opt out. He's got 4 years and $88 million left. I don't know if he's actually going to do much better than that, but the Tigers are clearly going to be rebuilding. So I think he decided that he didn't want to do that. And I believe he actually kind of told the team, like, this is probably what I'm going to do. And that sort of helped move things along. Now, there's a couple teams that you could have seen Justin Upton being a fit on. I was actually surprised the Angels pulled the trigger because that just hasn't really been their style. But not only did they do that, they got Upton and they got Brandon Phillips. And we can talk about how valuable those two guys are in just a second. But I think there's a huge amount of value of not necessarily feeling you have to get superstars, but just filling in these really like dark spots in the lineup. And if you look at the Angels, their second baseman this year had a 259 weighted on base, 59 weighted runs created plus, each easily the worst in baseball. That was mostly Danny Espinosa, who they cut a few weeks ago. Their left fielders, mostly Ben Revere and Cameron Maben, 290 weighted on base, 80 weighted runs created plus, each 28th in baseball. These are two spots that have been issues for them for quite some time. And now they've filled them, you know, either competently or above averagely. And that's a big deal for a team that is only a game and a half out of the playoffs.
I love this trade for the Angels for like a variety of reasons. It's, as you said, it's a big just upgrade for them. And they need it. And Upton's having the best season of his career. Offensively, which sort of surprised me when I looked closely at it yesterday. Best, second best. It's close.
It's close enough. He's having one of the best seasons of a very good career.
He's still relatively young. He turned
30 last week.
Turned 30 last week, and he could have blocked trades to 20 teams. The Angels are one of the 9 teams he could not block a trade to, which indicates that this may be a place where he will not opt out. Because the biggest reason he was going to opt out was because he's going to be playing on a rebuilding team in Detroit. But now he's going to be playing for a team that, well, maybe isn't like built to win with him now, with Trout. It's like, okay, this is a team that probably could stay in contention for at least a couple of years. And as you said, it's not necessarily clear he's going to do much better on the free agent market. So I could see him sticking around the Angels. So it's a calculated risk for the Angels, but it's not like they gave up that much to get him. So,
yeah, I mean, I think a week ago it was like 99.9% likely that opt-out was going to happen. And now it's maybe more of a 50-50. You know, I mean, who knows where he actually wants to be, but I think it's tough to see him getting a lot more money than he has. And if he likes playing, you know, with the Angels, who I think tried to sign him in the first place, then maybe he does stick around. And the Angels are going to lose a lot of money off their payroll this winter, right? $26 million they're still paying to Josh Hamilton this year. And this is the final year of that. $8 million to Ricky Nolasco, and the Twins are covering the other four. $9 million to Houston Street. $7 million to Yunel Escobar. Almost $6 million to Jesse Chavez. $4 million for Ben Revere. A couple other guys making $2 million apiece. There are a lot of dollars that are coming off the payroll, even though they are still paying a ton to Trout and paying a ton to Albert Pujols. They can still fit this in if he decides to stay. And it's out of their hands now, honestly.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is there's a player to be named later in the trade, and I wonder if it's tied to whether or not he opts out or not. That like basically,
that's interesting.
Yeah, like if that's part of the discussion where like they may, if he stays, the Angels will send something a little better than if he opts out. I don't know exactly how the machinations of that work, but I am left wondering. But I think he's a great fit. The Angels are in the thick of the wild card race, amazingly. Actually, I shouldn't say amazingly. In the preseason, I said that they were a dark horse wild card contender, and you mocked me for it.
So
I should be saying,
I don't understand how this is happening.
Yeah, but I should say, obviously, the Angels are in the wild card race, despite losing Mike Trout for 6 weeks.
The one thing we knew about the Angels coming into the season is that they would have an extremely good defense up the middle, right? Because obviously Trout in center, but Simmons has been fantastic on both sides of the ball. Espinosa didn't hit, but he was a good defender. And so now that they're going to have this defense, has been helping them kind of overcome a questionable pitching situation. I mean, if you look at the rotation right now, Nolasco has not been that great. Parker Bridwell has been kind of a pleasant surprise, but pretty clearly overperforming his peripherals. Tyler Skaggs, Andrew Heaney's been pretty nice since he's been back. And reportedly, Garrett Richards could be back in the rotation as soon as next week. I don't know if you can actually count on him, but we love Garrett Richards.
Yeah, he pitched, speaking of guys with high spin rate, he pitched in AAA this week, and I know that I saw Pedro Mora was tweeting about it, saying that he was the stadium gun in the AAA park, so take that with a grain of salt, had him at like 95, 96. So if Garrett Richards comes back, that's a big, I mean, I wouldn't expect much, but that's an X factor. If he can give you anything, even if he just gives you two good starts, that's something. The Angels, they're an interesting team. And now with Upton, with Trout, you look at the middle of the order, it's like, okay, this lineup suddenly looks a lot more formidable. And yeah. Upton's kind of an interesting player because like when he was drafted, it was like he was sort of considered one of these, maybe not generational, but like, oh my God, this is a ridiculous
number one overall
pick. And like he's had a good career. So like when it's all said and done, he might seem like, but he's never taken that leap. But like he sort of reminds me of Pat Burrell, that like when all said and done, if you look back at who was also number one overall pick, if you go back, when all said and done, you look at his career, it's like, that guy had a pretty good career. But like because he didn't become like the super duper star that people expected, he might feel like a little bit of a letdown, but like,
he's an extremely useful player right now. 362 on base, 542 slugging. He has the 20th best. He's tied for 20th best weighted runs created plus in baseball this year. That's nothing to sneeze at. I mean, being top 20 in anything is pretty impressive. And they also got Brandon Phillips from Atlanta. And I was kind of surprised when I looked this up. You sort of think, oh, he's 36. He's been around forever. He's, you know, comfortably into his decline phase. And it's not necessarily true. If you look at his career, with the exception of his career year in 2011, where he was kind of wildly out of norm with the rest of the work he's done, he's essentially been the exact same guy every single year. And I actually mean that, right? So listen, this year, he's hitting .291. .329 on base, and a .423 slugging. Last year, he had .291 with a .320 on base, a .416 slugging. For his career, he's hit .276 with a .320 on base, a .421 slugging. He has literally been the exact same guy, just a slightly below league average hitter, for about the last 12 years. Like, that is consistency to me, and that might not sound exciting, but remember, they had the worst second base situation in baseball. All you need to do is fill these holes, and all of a sudden you've got yourself a pretty competent lineup.
Yeah, it's a nice little pickup for them. You know, as you said, he's consistent. He's fun to watch play second base. He's got great hands. You know, it's with him, and we're going to see some very cool-looking double plays
with him and Andrelton
Simmons.
And Atlanta put him at third base for the last month, and he'd never played there before, and he actually did reasonably well. I'll go back to second base here with the Angels, but I am pretty excited to see him and Simmons and Trout right up the middle. I mean, this is an exciting team now.
It's an exciting team. The AL wildcard race is wide open. I feel like the Twins, Yankees, and Angels are going to sort of at some point make it a three-team race just because I trust their depth more. The thing that's interesting about the Yankees' schedule from here on out is the Yankees play almost exclusively contenders from here on out, and not just the teams in their own division. They also have a series against Minnesota and a series against Kansas City just randomly. So it's not like they didn't even like the worst team they play based on record is the Blue Jays. So like they don't even have any random series against the A's or the White Sox. Granted, there aren't that many American League teams who are out of it completely, but like they basically are only playing teams in the race. So, and they have six more against the Orioles who are still hanging around. So every Yankees game from here on out is kind of like has impact on the standings.
What I need to do now is look up the September schedule for the Tigers, because they are kind of go to White Sox territory right now for the right reasons, for sure. But it's going to be a rough end of the season, I think, for Detroit. And then also, for some reason, Cameron Maybin went from the Angels to the Astros, which, I don't know, is kind of confusing because the Astros have a ton of outfielders, but he's very fast. He can be a good outfielder off the bench. Giancarlo Stanton has not homered in the last 2 days, which is almost a shocking report at this point, because it seemed like he was on an every other day home run stretch. But he does have 51 home runs through 133 team games. There are 29 Marlins games remaining. He hit 18 home runs in August, and he still has a pretty decent shot at 61. It almost feels like a given, as crazy as that sounds to say. Getting to 74? I don't know about that. To get to 74 home runs, which would break the all-time record of 73 set by Barry Bonds, he would need to get 21 home runs in the remaining 29 games. That's one every 1.4 games. As great as Stanton is, and there are things in his favor, which we'll talk about in a second, I don't think that's going
to
happen.
Yeah, for me, it's all – I want to see 60, because I think that's just a cool milestone. I know, like, 61 has the romance of Roger Maris, but I almost – like, it's just annoying to have that conversation. People get into, like, well, 61's the real record. It's not. 73 is the record. 60 just cool. I mean, only five other players have ever hit 60 home runs in a season. Like, it's insane.
You can have something at the same time not be the all-time record and still be extremely cool. Like, these are not mutually exclusive. You can do that. And so I am excited to see him get to what I assume he will get to 60. Where he lands, I don't know, 63, 64, maybe something like that. But here's what's working in his favor. If you look at the Marlins' September schedule, they have, I think, 9 series left, right? And so at home, who's going to come through Miami? The Phillies. Not exactly a top-notch pitching staff. The Braves, not exactly a top-notch pitching staff. Now, the Washington Nationals are obviously very good. The Brewers are still fighting for a playoff spot, and then the Mets are coming through. And then, you never really know who's going to be pitching for the Mets at any given time. But look at their road trips. They go to Atlanta, and that ballpark is definitely a more hitter-friendly park than the previous Braves park was. They go to Philadelphia. It's definitely a hitter's park.
Certainly a homer-friendly park.
And then they go, their last road trip of the season is through Arizona and through Colorado. He hasn't been to Colorado yet this year, hasn't been to Arizona yet this year. And that's exciting, because this is kind of the second half of the month. Maybe he goes in there, and this could still be a playoff implication game, by the way. He could maybe go through this 6-game road trip and be sitting on like 58 or whatever at that point, and we all want to see him hit like 9 home runs at altitude. That's exciting. To me.
Yeah, I mean, those are the two best home run parks in baseball, certainly the National League, in baseball.
I mean, well, sort of. I mean, Colorado, it's not always about home runs there. It's also about like doubles and triples, just because the ballpark's so big. But he's played 20 games in his career in Colorado. He has homered in 10 of those games. So that is a pretty nice place for him to be. Now the question is, since those teams will be fighting each other most likely for the wild card, will anybody pitch to him? Yeah, that's the question. Like, if you have to worry about losing the game, do you just pitch around him? I don't know, but it's something that be concerned about, I guess.
And it's also going to be September expanded rosters when teams go to the bullpen well a lot earlier. So you could see some just like relievers you've never heard of facing Giancarlo Stanton in the fifth inning of a tight game, and that reliever just being like, what do I do?
Well, I know that when he is playing those games in Coors Field, I'll be watching pretty much every pitch, because that's going to be exciting. But I do want to raise a question. Is Stanton this year better than the 2015 version of Giancarlo Stanton? And I know that sounds insane, because he's been crushing the ball for months. But if we look at expected weighted on base, which combines quality of contact with amount of contact, this year his expected weighted on base is 409, which is obviously very good. Last year it was only 347. We know he struggled a lot. In 2015, it was 413, so it was actually slightly better. He only played 74 games due to injury, but he did have a 606 slugging percentage and 27 home runs. So if you just look at the quality of contact, that seems pretty identical. So what's different? This year he's overperforming, as you would expect, a little bit. His expected 409 versus an actual 433, as opposed to 2 years ago, expected 413 versus an actual 397. So there's that. And then there's also the fact that the Stanton you're thinking about right now for this year is not the same Stanton we've seen all year long since he changed his stance, which we've pinned at June 19th. His expected weighted on base is 459. His actual is 481. So the Stanton over the last 2.5 months, slightly different from the Stanton over the first 2.5 months, and that counts too.
Yeah, no, there was a really good piece written on our site by the aforementioned David Adler that sort of broke down the change in his stance. It's really glaring. Like, if you haven't really paid attention, he now is really closed up. Like, his front foot is really, you know, it's almost touching the, like, inside part of the batter's box. So he's really, it's a very much a different look for him. And it's, you know, hitters tinker all the time. We don't necessarily think about it because, like, at some point when this isn't working for him, he'll probably change again and open up again. But, like, for now, since he's done that, he's been ridiculous.
Is there a term for whatever the opposite of your foot in the bucket is? Because that's basically what he's doing, right? Like, he's got his lead foot is, like, facing towards right field, and he's still getting around on balls. He's still pulling balls down at third baseline, which is crazy.
Yeah, and what's interesting now, too, is he going to be the NL MVP? I kind of think if he gets to 60, yes, but...
You know, Paul Goldschmidt's been really, really good lately, and you know, they are probably going to have the we made the playoffs thing, and the Marlins most likely won't. I mean, you could argue for Charlie Blackmon, too, although we talked last week about his crazy home road splits. I do think right now the top four are in some order Stanton, Goldschmidt, Blackmon, and Votto, I guess. So people are going to freak out when Nolan Arenado finishes like sixth, I guess.
But I mean, I don't think if you're going to factor in like didn't make the playoffs, I can't see Votto winning it over Stanton, even though there's a good chance when all is said and done by the numbers, Votto may have had a more valuable season based on something like weighted runs created,
sure, plus,
whatever. But I think if someone from a non-playoff team is going to win it, it's going to be Stanton.
I agree with you on that, but I still think Votto could finish top four.
Yeah, I think so.
So, you know, it would have been Harper before he got hurt in the mix. Anthony Rendon, for some reason, nobody's paying attention to how good he's been. None of the Dodgers, I don't think, will get it because a lot of those guys have missed time. So I do think Stanton's got a chance, and I do think if he's going to win it, he has to hit at least 60. If he doesn't, then he's not going to win.
Yeah, I think that's my prediction, if for lack of a better word, is if he hits 60, he wins. If not, Goldschmidt.
That's pretty hilarious to think that the difference between 59 and 60 could actually decide a major award, but you might actually be right. And it just seems more likely than ever, I think, that Stanton remains in Miami for a while. I don't think Derek Jeter and new ownership is going to trade him right away. That's probably not the best impression to make on the new fans.
And also, I just don't think, you know, there's been a lot of this rumor about Stanton. Oh, maybe they'll trade him. But I think it's just hard to construct a trade for Stanton that would satisfy anyone, because if you're going to trade for Stanton, you're taking on a big contract. You know, we have it written down here. I'm trying to figure out how much is left. Basically 10 years left on the deal, plus a 2028 option. We're basically making 25 up to $32 million per year.
He's only been paid about $40 million of the contract
$325 million contract. So, like, if you trade for him, you're like, well, I don't want to give up a lot. I'm taking on this huge contract. And if you're the Marlins, you're not going to trade him unless you're getting elite prospects back. So, like, the only way you can foresee a trade is if the Marlins threw in a lot of money to get better prospects. And I just can't see that happening either. So I don't want to say they're stuck with him, but I think they probably don't feel like they're stuck with him. Right now they're like, hey, we finally have the stand we've been sort of waiting for, a fully healthy season. Because in 15, he was a beast, but he also got hurt and missed – he was kind of on pace for 50 homers, so he was going to be the Stanton we've been waiting for, but he was never able to stay healthy for a full season. His career high before this year was 37 homers, as hard as that is to believe. Now he's at, what, 51?
51.
So I think he's going to be – I mean, he has an opt-out after 2020, but at the same time, like, it's hard to, you know,
who passes up that amount of money?
Yeah, so I think he's going to be a Marlin for a while.
This is the Stanton we always hoped we'd see, and now we're seeing it. And let's move on to another extremely large baseball man who crushes baseballs. If you look at the second half leaders who have had at least 75 post-All-Star game plate appearances, and you were to rank them by expected weighted on base, very unsurprisingly, Giancarlo Stanton is number one at 481. Also on the top five list, Votto, Rizzo, Blackmon, all make sense. Who is number two? I think it might take people a minute to figure out who has actually had the second best quality of contact after the All-Star game. It's Joey Gallo, who you think of as barely ever making contact, which is to some extent true. Joey Gallo at a 447 expected weighted on base is the second best hitter by this metric in the second half. which I find amazing because Joey Gallo strikes out constantly, but he's still been extremely valuable.
Joey Gallo is the best. He's my favorite player in baseball right now, non-Luis Perdomo division. Not for many reasons, not even including the fact that every time I say his name, I think of the my cousin Vinny, Joey Gallo. Joey Gallo. He's dead. Anyway, but he is the ultimate three true outcomes hitter. And I've always been a fan of three true outcomes hitters. And for those who aren't familiar with the phrase, these are players who do three things above all else: hit homers, strike out, or walk. And the patron saint is probably, depending on who you ask, is maybe Rob Deer. It's maybe Adam Dunn.
Dunn is what I was gonna say.
But what Gallo is doing, and we'll get to this in a second, it's sort of goes beyond anything that Adam Dunn ever did. And it's sort of amazing to think that he's taken three true outcomes to a whole new level.
Just listen to his triple slash line. .207 batting average. That will not impress very many people. .330 on base percentage. That's pretty good. I think it's slightly above league average. .561 slugging percentage. Now, if you remember, really batting average doesn't matter so much. So those last two numbers are what matters. That's a .128 weighted runs created plus. That's basically 30% above league average. That's really good. That's an extremely valuable player. He was a borderline all-star this year. And he's also leading baseball right now, minimum 70 batted balls, in highest hard hit percentage, which we've defined as 95 miles an hour of exit velocity or over. He's number one. Aaron Judge is still number two. Alex Avila, who we've talked about a lot, and Chris with a K, Davis. So when he hits the ball, which is not often, he hits it harder, more often than basically anybody in baseball.
Yeah, it's actually, if you'd asked me in May, it was hard to fathom anyone would surpass Aaron Judge in the hard hit leaderboard category. Yeah. But Joey Gallo has done it. And this is my favorite stat about Joey Gallo right now, is that right now he has 36 home runs and 21 singles, which is by far the highest home run to single ratio for a player who qualified for a batting title. In fact, in baseball history, it's only happened three times where qualified hitters have had more home runs than singles. And they are Mark McGwire in 1998, when he set the home run record. He had 70 home runs and 61 singles. He did it again the next year. It was 65 homers and 63 singles. And then Barry Bonds in 2001, when he had 73 homers. And I should have written this down. It's
and that was different too, because he just wasn't getting pitched to.
Yeah.
So he would basically homer or nothing else. And he had 700 intentional walks or whatever that year.
So right now Joey Gallo is, who has 36 home runs and 21 singles, is poised to shatter the home run to single ratio record, as if that's a thing I've invented. He also has 36 home runs and 38 non-home runs. So basically, it's almost a one-to-one ratio of home for hits of home runs versus non-home runs.
And it was. 2 days ago, it was. It was 36 and 36. And then he had to make it slightly less cool by, not getting home runs.
And it should be 37 for 37, because if you were watching
that's right,
the Rangers-Astros game in the Tropicana Field yesterday, he hit one with 110-mile-an-hour exit velocity, 38-degree launch angle that was projected to go over 400 feet that hit the catwalk and bounced in the field, so it was in play, and it was a double. So it wasn't a single, got a double out of it. So he preserved the home run to single ratio, but he should be at 37 right now.
Well, and 37 is also his whiff rate. He has a 37% strikeout rate. That is tied for the second highest of any qualified season ever, behind only Keon Broxton this year, 37.5%. So, that's what he does. He strikes out a lot, but he crushes the ball. He is so much fun to watch. I love him. I love everything about Joey Gallo, especially the fact that he's hitting .207, because I like telling people he's still a valuable player.
Yeah, and to go back to that point I made about Adam Dunn before. So Adam Dunn, from 2004 through 2008, where he hit more than 40 homers every year and hit exactly 40 homers every year from 2005 to 2008. In that stretch, where he was basically the peak three true outcomes hitter, he averaged 41 homers and 64 singles. So even just to give you a sense, Gallo is destroying the Adam Dunn ratio in terms of home runs to singles. And Russell Branyon, another guy who's a part-time player who I think of as another kind of classic three true outcomes guy. In his best year, 2009, in fact, the only year he qualified for the batting title, he had 31 homers and 55 singles. So Joey Gallo is scoffs at Russell Branyon and Adam Dunn when it comes to three true outcomes and hitting singles.
Well, Joey Gallo is a member of the Texas Rangers, who have one of the more interesting lineups in baseball. And part of this is for a reason I don't think I've even told you about yet. So if you look at their second baseman, you have Rougui Odor. He has 27 home runs and he has a .253 on base. That is the lowest on base percentage ever in history for a season with 27 plus home runs. If you look at history, Tony Armas did it a couple times. He had a .254 on base in 1983. guys like Dave Kingman, Tony Bautista, Corey Snyder on the list. Look who else is on this list. The very bottom of our list here, Mike Napoli this year has 28 home runs with a .278 on base percentage. They have two guys on the same Texas team who just about never get on base, but they can still hit home runs. I don't know if that's the most effective way to get to a lineup, and then you mix them in with Joey Gallo, and there's just a lot happening in our lineup right now.
You've got Joey Gallo and two guys who can hit home runs almost like Gallo, but never walk.
Right. Which is, I don't know, it's not exactly what the way you would draw it up, I guess, but it's at least interesting. I think Odor is kind of a fascinating case because it sure looked like he broke out or was going to break out a couple of years ago. And it just, I don't know, he's taken a bit of a step back this year in the on-base percentage. You can't get by with a .253 for that long, right?
Yeah, he's always sort of like, he was never going to be a big walk guy, but this year now the batting average has cratered a little bit, whereas like last year he hit like .270, so it's sort of like it bumped up. The OBP was actually above .300, I think, last year. But this year it's just, I mean, I think he's amongst, in terms of weighted runs created plus, his weighted runs created plus is 66, where average is 100. Of 155 batting title qualifiers, he ranks 149th.
That's not great.
That is not good. And the thing is that, like, from the quality of contact standpoint, this is not really a fluke. His expected weighted on base is .289. His weighted on base is .284. So even last year, his good year, his expected weighted on base was .310. So it was a little better, but not like significantly better. And 2 years ago, when his overall season line looked a lot more like this year's season line, his expected weighted on base was .292. He's still pretty young, but it sort of just feels like what you see is what you get.
Well, I mean, they need him to improve. He's in the first year of a 6-year extension. They've signed him from 2017 through 2022 for just under $50 million. There's also an option for one more year after that. And I think that they, you know, as you said, they never expected elite on-base skills, but I think you need a little bit more than this. And you dug up a really weird stat about him, which I kind of like. He's the only left-handed hitting second baseman in Major League history who stands less than 6 feet tall to hit 30 home runs in a season. That's literally never happened before. And he's
done it twice before, and he's going to do it a third time again this year.
So he is one of the, I don't know, he's just unique in a lot of ways.
I mean, the long-term deal, I mean, even at the back end, they're paying him $12 million a year. So it's not like, he's never going to, like, be the reason that they're a disaster. Like, he's never going to be like, oh my God, this Odor contract is dragging us down. But at the same time, when you sign these deals to players and you buy out the arbitration years, you're expecting them to, like, produce well beyond. You're sort of hoping for the bargain as a team. You're investing them. And we've seen in the last couple of years, we've seen a few of these deals kind of look like they might back. I mean, this is like sort of famously how the Indians built their team in the mid-90s, you know, the John Hart plan, giving guys like I guess it was Baerga and Albert Bell and
Manny. Did he get one? I don't remember.
I can't exactly remember. Buying out the arbitration years, but like last couple of years, you know, the Odor one not looking so good. Stephen Piscotty not looking so great. Cardinals also did with Alan Craig. That did not work out.
And some of them are so young, you can bounce back. I was like, the Colton Wong one didn't look very good either, but he's actually been playing pretty well over the last
year. Yeah, but it's months. So it's interesting. I mean, again, but from the team perspective, when it's this team-friendly, it's never going to, like, really crush you on the back end.
Right. And now it is time to finish off our show by inducting a new play into the StatCast Hall of Fame, which this week is presented by Tap Sports Baseball 2017. We are going to finally induct a fantastic-looking Kevin Pillar catch into our StatCast Hall of Fame. And I say finally because he may have the biggest discrepancy in baseball between, I think, the eye test and the data. Everything he does just looks great. Like, he has got his signature play. He goes out and he makes a Superman dive. You know, Javi Baez has his tags. Manny Machado has his, I'm going to go basically into the dugout and throw you out across my shoulder. This is what Kevin Pillar does. He makes everything look so great. And I think that's why Blue Jays fans love him so much. So the other night, Monday night against Mookie Betts, he had a catch that was measured at a 38% catch probability. That is a 4-star catch. The ball was hit a projected 368 feet and Pillar was 83 feet away. He had to go and get it in 4.6 seconds and he got there with a 29.9 foot per second sprint speed, where 30 feet per second is elite. That was his second best catch of the season by catch probability. So that's great. This is one of the times where it looked awesome and the data backs it up. That was a 4-star catch. So welcome to the Hall of Fame, Kevin Pillar.
Yeah, what's notable you mentioned is that sprint speed of 29.9 feet per second, because I think part of the disconnect that we might be seeing with Kevin Pillar overall is that the metrics were kinder to him a couple years ago, and then he might actually be losing a step. In 2015, we had his sprint speed, his average sprint speed measured at 28.6 feet per second. 2015 was kind of when he burst on the scene as like this elite outfielder. So 28.6 feet per second, that's elite speed. Average is 27. So 28.6 is high end. I mean, for a center fielder, it's not like it doesn't blow you away, but it's up there. Then last year, it dropped to 28.0 feet per second. This year, it's 27.9. So when you think about maybe Pilar, why our metrics aren't loving him as much, that's a big reason why.
Right. And in mid-September, we are going to come out with one of our next-generation StatCast stats, which is going to be outs above average, which will measure basically the cumulative effects of each individual catch probability play. And we will put it into, you know, one number that you can look at. And he is going to have, and this might change by then, but at the moment, he's going to have the second largest drop from last year to this year. And the first largest drop is Adam Eaton, who got hurt and missed like basically the entire season.
I don't even count it. I mean, I don't even think you should count Eaton. If you're going by innings played,
sure,
like, he has the biggest drop.
I'm just looking at the overall.
I'm just saying, but like Pilar, for all intents and purposes, has the biggest drop.
Right. And at the moment, we would have him going down from plus 15 outs above average to negative 2. And I think that that is going to be a little controversial. But I will say this. I always like to look at some of the other stats that are out there just as a smell test. And, you know, so DRS and UZR and only the range components, because I'm not worried about, you know, arm strength or anything right now. DRS has him dropping from 24 to 11. UZR has him dropping from 22 to 1. So we're at least in the ballpark there. I think we can sell that and say, hey, we're not the only ones who say maybe he's still good, but he's not quite what he looked like.
And it's another reminder that catch probability is, it's not only about speed, but speed is a huge component of it, because it's basically a range measure. It's like, how far did you go to make a play? Like, how much time did you have to make a play, and how far did you have to go to make it?
And what direction did
it? So it's like, that's really it. So it's testing the boundaries of your range. And like, you know, so if you, for me, for example, if I was trying to make a catch, I may have to dive on a play that Kevin Pillar was camped under, to give you an extreme example. So like, sometimes guys make diving catches. So he makes these diving catches where maybe Byron Buxton would be camped under it, or maybe 2 years ago, Kevin Pillar would have been camped under it.
Yeah, and I can tell you that's one of our offseason projects. I've seen just the very, very first version of this is trying to get to the heart of, are outfielders good because of speed or because of skill? You know, and skill could be instincts, it could be, you know, great route, whatever. And it's going to be pretty interesting. Some guys are great at both. We've talked about Ender Inciarte. He's a fantastic outfielder, but he's not terribly fast, all things considered. So I think that'll be something very cool, and that's a winter project. But one other thing I wanted to talk about on this catch is he was playing really, really deep, right? So the average center fielder plays 318 feet away from home plate. Kevin Pillar's average is 322 feet away from home plate. On this catch, he was 334 feet away from home plate and actually shaded over towards right field, and the ball went to the right field gap. So just based on where he was standing, it was actually a little easier for him to catch than if he was standing where he usually was. And it made me think of a play from a couple weeks ago when they were in Wrigley Field, and he made a great catch against Chris Bryant and basically disappeared into the ivy. 340 feet away from home plate. That's where he was standing. So that makes it a little bit easier when you don't have to go an extra 22 feet as compared to the major league average.
And reminder, as you know, we don't, catch probability does not give style points. We love catches with style points,
yes.
But the metric is agnostic to dives and leaps.
I think it really helps someone like Kevin Kiermaier, who makes everything look easy. And I think Kevin Pillar is kind of the other end, where he's a good outfielder, but he just makes everything look so cool, which is great because he's exciting and I love watching him play. So welcome to the StatCast Hall of Fame for your robbery of Mookie Betts, Kevin Pillar. That is our StatCast Hall of Fame play for this week, brought to you by Tap Sports Baseball 2017. Go to the iTunes or Google Play App Store now to download it today for free and start building your ultimate roster. That's our StatCast podcast for this week. No show next week with the holiday week. We will catch you when we come back. Thanks for listening.